Generation after generation has asked this question, how do we connect with our culture? In a way that does justice to the truth that we believe in, but in a way that resonates with where people are at. So just by way of review, what I'm looking at is starting with that, a pathway out of shame, I'm calling it, because actually what's happened, I think, is that our world has moved, certainly in the West, from a sense of wrongdoing, we've done something wrong and we need to be forgiven, to a place where many people feel there's something wrong with them. Not that they've done something wrong, because post-modernity doesn't work in that way. Modernity was set up around transactions and laws and a sense of justice and right and wrong. Post-modernity doesn't sit in that space in quite the same way. It's more about how I feel about something, who I'm connected to, and my truth is my truth and your truth is your truth. So to use Leslie Newbegin's phrase, there is no longer a sense of publicly owned truth. Leslie Newbegin, quite a famous Christian missionary who came back and started writing about what he felt was happening in the West. So he says we've lost our sense of publicly owned truth. So you can no longer say, well, God thinks you've done wrong and you need to change and be forgiven and be doing right things in quite the same as you could historically in modernity. We still need to say that, that's still part of our truth, but it's probably not the thing that will resonate most with our culture, particularly with younger people, with the millennials and Generation Z. Particularly, I was with, I mentioned this last week, the local 267 project who works with youth, working with 20 or so local youth and children's workers, talking about this just 10 days or so ago. And interesting to hear their responses to what they felt was helpful and appropriate to connect with this slightly younger generation. So it's not about truth anymore in quite the same way as it would have been over here. Chris Evans, the local schools worker, picked up on that, said to me several years ago, young people aren't interested in whether it's true so much as they're interested in whether it works or not. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting observation, interesting reflection. So that's part of what's going on here. So what we're going to look at today is that sort of shame pathway, which we'll get to in a minute. So that's the sort of starting place, really, the felt need out there. I think underneath that needs to sit a culture in our Christian communities that works out of that golden thread that runs through the New Testament called the one another's. There are 58 or so one another statements, love one another, forgive one another, teach and admonish one another throughout the New Testament. They're all things that connect us with each other, build relationships between us. They're not about somebody in a priestly capacity connecting us together or connecting us with God. It's about us discovering God together, sharing life together. And those one another's, I think, sit as the container that we need to be working out of as Christian communities to create a culture, an environment, an atmosphere where people, as we'll see, who are stepping out of shame, a sense of a lack of trust that often goes with that, a sense of not I've done something wrong, but there's something wrong with me, a sense of acceptance that is felt as those people join our Christian communities, rather than a sense of judgment that they have to step through, which has perhaps been the case in the past. So our Christian communities need to be shaped, I think, around those one another's, to connect with people who are coming from our culture, from that sense of a lost sense of identity. That's the way that I put it, I suppose. And then underneath that, the fact that leadership enables that culture. So leadership facilitates, creates atmospheres and environments where that one another culture can exist. So it's not the dominant force, it's intentionally sat at the bottom of this triangle because leadership supports the culture that then is this one another culture, which actually takes greater leadership rather than less leadership. It's less dominant leadership, it's probably less seen leadership, it's less vocal leadership, but it takes more leadership because it involves a greater risk. So it involves more adventure and a greater sense of openness which demands a bigger heart from those in leadership to open up that space to allow that to happen, which many of us in leadership want to close down. We want to be in control. We want to know what's happening, what's going on, how everything connects together and works. We need to let go of that to some degree to open up the space. That's a very quick sort of bum, 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 bum of some of the things we touched on last week. So that's where we're, that's the background really, hopefully brings you into the space. If you worked around last week, what I also did, which we'll just do briefly, is use my three planks, because I find they're really helpful as visual representations of the bridge that we might use or think about to connect from our sense of Christian community into our culture. And this first plank, which Jason Georges describes in his great little book, The 3D Gospel, as the guilt and innocence plank, which is the one that we've used in modernity. I feel guilty, I need to be made innocent, Jesus comes and dies in our place, is sacrificed on our behalf, so that that guilt can be forgiven, so that we can then approach God. Second plank, we're just going to whisk through these, is what Jason describes. Jason is a missionary by background, currently teaching in the States. And he describes this as the fear and power bridge. We're fearful, most of us are, we're honest. And God is all powerful. So God offers us his power to overcome our fear. Jason says this is predominantly a bridge that connects into the African continent. I'm heading off flying to Tanzania on Friday evening, so I will step into this space and experience that fear and power sort of dynamic going on, whether that's the sort of tension between local witch doctors and the spiritual world that's very alive in Africa in a way that it isn't here in quite the same way. Seeing God's power step into those spaces. And you can think of lots of things, I'm sure, around that sort of dynamic. Here, it's about Jesus' death in our place. Here, it's about Jesus' resurrection, Jesus conquering death, our biggest fear, death. Still is the case, still the number one. Jesus overcomes that because he's risen again. He conquers death. And then this final plank, which is where I want us to focus this morning, as I promised last week, we will get there, which Jason Georges describes as shame and honour, particularly connects into an Asian culture. So there is something wrong with me, a sense of lost identity, I don't belong, I'm disconnected, that sense of shame, loss of value, loss of purpose, loss of hope. Which is different from I've done something wrong. So a shift there from I've done something wrong to there's something wrong with me. And then in cultural terms, this idea that we're coming out of shame and looking to be honoured, looking to be valued, looking to have status, those sorts of things, which bring about a transformation, taking us from this place of shame, disconnection, lost sense of value, into a place of honour. Well, as I've been thinking about this and writing about it, I've been particularly challenged to think, okay, what does Jesus have to say to this, and particularly what does the cross have to say about this shame and honour idea? And as I've thought about that and read several commentators, particularly looking at this whole idea of shame, Brené Brown, who some of you will have come across, makes some fascinating observations out of her research, which she's now been doing for probably 12 years plus, written several books. There's a few on the back there if you want to have a look at them. So she makes the comment that shame is at epidemic proportions in our Western culture. Shame is at epidemic proportions in our Western culture. Quite, I think, an insightful comment from her research. She says, if you put shame in a little petri dish in a laboratory, if you could do that, it would thrive on secrecy, silence, and judgment. They're the three components that encourage shame to thrive. Secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you take that same petri dish and you douse it with empathy, it can't survive. Petri dish with shame in it, douse it with empathy, it can't survive. And I read those words and I thought, wow, fantastic. That's good news. It's great news for us. Because we have a God who comes in the person of Jesus and empathizes with us. So we have, if you like, the key to Brené Brown's research to unlock this idea of empathy. What does that look like? How do we communicate that? Is what I want us to look at this morning. So my plan is just to talk for probably another 10 or so minutes, 15 at the outside, and then to hear back from you, so that we get a conversation going rather than you just listening to me, which, you know, it's probably a bit in a warm day like this. So we'll have some engagement in a few moments' time. So we're thinking about a pathway out of shame, building a bridge for the gospel message into our UK culture of shame, based around showing empathy and breaking secrecy, silence, and judgment. I did some notes which I put out last week, and I've got a few copies of further notes which unpack some of the points that I just want to highlight today. If you're interested to explore it further, then do pick a copy of those up. So where do we start with this? What might we say into this space? Well, I think the starting place for me is the fact that Jesus' incarnation, Jesus coming and dwelling amongst us, needs to be a priority for us. Not something that we just take out of the box in the loft at Christmas and celebrate once a year, but something that we highlight 365 days of the year, that God is amongst us. Not just in the person of Jesus, but God cares about our world, something that is often not very high on our agenda, because over here it didn't really matter. What mattered here was the transaction, that Jesus came to die. That was the dominant feature. Over here, it's different. Jesus comes to be with us. God is with us. He empathizes with us. That's what overcomes our shame. That's, if you like, our starting place. We have a couple of problems with that. One is that recent research shows that many people, or most people in the UK, think that Jesus is a mythical figure, you know, on a par with a cartoon character or Superman or Spider-Man or something like that, but he wasn't the real person. 46% of those interviewed in the Talking Jesus research said that they didn't believe Jesus was a real person. So there's a starting point for us to actually do work around the fact that Jesus was a historical figure, which is quite easy in some ways to build a case for, but obviously is not something that most people are aware of. Because you can't empathize with somebody who isn't like you. And Superman and a comic character are not like you. To empathize with you, you need to be in the same space as that person. That's the whole idea of empathy. So that's a good starting place for us to think about those things. The other thing is, the very container that we might communicate or have these conversations in needs to be a space where trust is developed, where there's a sense of openness, where people are prepared to step out of their secrecy, silence, and fear of judgment, and be open and honest. And what that means is that we've got to be in that space, because we can't build this bridge of empathy ourselves unless we're prepared to be open and honest and vulnerable ourselves. What that says to me is that some of the things that we do on Sunday morning that we've just done, for instance, move into that space a little bit. They're hearing from each other, telling those stories, sharing what's going on. But ultimately, I think these things will need to happen in smaller groups where there is a sense of belonging and trust and openness. So not surprising that a couple of examples of this that I've shared in my writing is the Enneagram group that Jill very... I don't know how to describe what you do, but you host this space beautifully, Jill, where people can come and talk about who they are out of a type description, which enables them to speak about themselves in an open space here, not feeling judged, not feeling that other people are critiquing them personally, but talking around this type space that we operate in. Very profound things happen in that space. And I think a lot of shame is broken through those sorts of conversations. So whatever tool you might use, whether it's this wonderful spiritual development tool called the Enneagram, with its Christian historical roots in the early desert fathers, which seems to be finding a renaissance in our culture at the moment. Not surprisingly, I think, because it's dealing in this space. Whether it's that, or whether it's conversations around a meal table, doing alpha, or whatever context it might be, I think we need to find more and more of these spaces where we have open and honest conversations with people. With each other, in our small groups, that's a good starting place. But then with others who will come and join us in those spaces. We have those conversations in the pottery on a regular basis. Jill's smiling at me because people come in with carrying this sense of shame. There's something wrong with me because I got told by an art teacher at school that I wasn't creative. You know, that hits our very roots of who we are because we're created in the image of a creator God. So that's hugely damaging to have that spoken over you as a 5, 6, 7, 8, 14 year old, whatever. And so to see people come out of that space, as they do, as we help them throw a mug or a jug or make something with their hands and discover that that's not true for them, that they do have a sense of identity that can be pushed against what was spoken over them, I think is really good. So that relational space, I think, is really, really important for us. Just flipping through my notes here, do pick a copy of these up if you're interested to look at a bit more about it. This idea of Jesus' incarnation, coming and being amongst us, demonstrating empathy with us. He came and it seems like such an obvious thing, but this week I thought Jesus' death is his ultimate identification with us in becoming human, because we all die. The fact that Jesus died and was prepared to die, not because over here, because God needed him to die to forgive us for our sins, but because he identified with us and empathized with us in our humanity and went to the cross and died to say, I'm in exactly the same space as you are. I'm fully human and I've become one of you, is a message that I think we need to get out there, because most people think that God is distant. Pulling the levers and pulleys, everything's his fault. And, you know, they don't think typically of God being amongst us, being around us, identifying with us. So we're whizzing through these. Let me just highlight a couple of others for you. So Jesus being with us. Jesus himself identifying with people in his own culture who were shamed by the culture of his day. Eating with tax collectors and sinners. Putting himself in spaces where people were excluded, were shamed, and bringing release for those captives, to use the Luke 4 phrase, and recovery of sight for the blind, and proclaiming the year of the Lord's favour into those spaces where people were shamed, where they were excluded, where they were told there was something wrong with them. Who are those people? Well, many of those people actually are in our younger generation, who believe that there is something wrong with them, who post wonderful things on Facebook, but inside are dying, because they can't keep up with their friends who are also posting wonderful things on Facebook, but also are dying inside. And this circle of competition that is going on around this whole idea of shame needs to be broken somehow. We need to step into that space. There's been quite a lot of research recently, hasn't there, and about the need for these youngsters to come off, to put their phones down, not to be on social media, to have a break. But what are they then doing in that space? Who are they? You know, if their identity is so locked up in, well, not just them actually, many of us probably spend quite a lot of time doing these sort of things as well. So what's that doing for who we are? For this sense of competition. Yeah, it's not you or I, Matthew. But some, maybe. So we're portraying something out here, performing in a way, when actually inside that doesn't resonate with us. There's a dissonance there. And there's a sense of envy, which is something else that goes with shame, that we're not as others are. So the shame that we're experiencing, I don't think is cultural, in that it is pushing against set boundaries. So it's not like, say over here, you'd done something wrong because you had a child out of wedlock and you were shamed, which you would have done historically. That's not the case anymore in the same way as it would have been. So what does this shame work around? I think it works around more of an inner psychological understanding of shame than an outward cultural idea of shame. It's how am I creating the image of myself internally? What does it feel like for me to be amongst my peers particularly? And how do I feel I'm measuring up compared to what they're doing? So that sort of purpose of background of shame that we're dealing with. So to step into those spaces as Jesus did, to have a sense of our own value that we can bring to that, but also convey something of the value that God has for each one of us into that space, I think is really, really important. You know, that we are created in his image, as we did in the worship, celebrating the fact that we're sons and daughters of God. That actually, Jesus goes, takes our shame on the cross, dies a shameful death, a criminal's death, not because of what he's done, but because of who he is and who he's included in his friends. That's why he dies, ultimately. At the hands of those who are basically running a shame culture and want him out of the way because he's a threat to them, he conquers death and returns to his Heavenly Father, and his Heavenly Father accepts him back in, welcomes him back in. That lovely story of the lost son from the New Testament is a depiction of what happens through the death and resurrection of Jesus and the ascension back. Having left the Trinity, so he's been excluded from the Trinity as he comes down and dwells amongst us. He's left them behind. He now rejoins them, even though he's carried his shame, our shame, with him. He's accepted back in. Very powerful. Motif there of what the death and resurrection of Jesus and his ascension mean in this context of shame. So a few things, there's several more. I came up with 14 little bullet points that we might like to think around in terms of how we talk about this shame idea. Many of Jesus' healing miracles were healing people, not just for their physical well-being, but for their social and psychological well-being. Because they were excluded because of their ailments. Most of them, I think. Hence, the questions to Jesus, with the blind man particularly, who is it who has sinned that has caused this man's ailment? There's something wrong with them. Somebody's done something wrong that has caused them to have something wrong with them. Therefore, we're excluding them. Jesus heals them so he can see, but also so that he can be included again in the society of his day, back into friendship, back into relationship, which is the ultimate thing that's going on here. So I'll just close with this statement, and then we'll open it up and have a bit of coming and going, because I'm sure it raises all sorts of questions and little thought patterns going on in all sorts of directions. We're so used to thinking about sin as wrongdoing over here. I've done something wrong, I need to be forgiven. But we need to think about sin in a different way over here. I shared the example last week, didn't I, of my friend who says over here what we used to do was throw a bucket of cold water over somebody and then offer them a towel. That's what it felt like. We had to convince them that they'd done things wrong, and then offer them salvation, offer them a way out of their wrongdoing. Over here, there is this lost sense of identity. It's tangible. You can see it. You can, you don't have to throw a bucket of cold water over anybody to convince them that their life is not as it should be. I'm not becoming the person that I think I should become. I'm not becoming the person that my friends, my family expect me to come. All that stuff is there. It's how we connect with it. So sin in this context is a lot of that sense of identity. It's putting our sense of identity somewhere else apart from where it should be, which is in God. Does that make sense? Think about the garden, back in Genesis 3, the serpent comes in and says, did God really say? And Adam and Eve go and hide because they realise that they've stepped away from God. They want to be in control of their own destiny. They want to know for themselves, to be able to decide what's good and what's evil, to have the knowledge of good and evil, as the writer of Genesis says. And through that, they realise they're naked, they go and hide, and God comes looking in the garden, walking in the cool of the evening, and the way that the writer puts it is if this is something he does every day, comes looking for Adam and Eve, and they're not there. And the first question of the Bible is, where are you? That loss of trust, that loss of connection, relationship, which is what this is about. It's about us drawing people back into their destiny, their sense of purpose and identity. I'm going to stop.